For our next segment, we have Starlin D'Angelo, the executive director of the Shaker Heritage Society. She's in the studio with us right now to tell us about the Shakers and the Watervliet site that's home to their remarkable museum. So, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. For our listeners who may not know a Shaker from a Quaker or a Mennonite, can you give us a quick rundown of who the Shakers are and were?
Well, they actually started in Manchester, England in the 1750s, and they're very different than those other groups, primarily because they had a very different concept of what a family is. So for them, it's not parents and children. It's, you know, 100 or 300 people living and working together in harmony and worshiping together as well. They were a communal religious society, so they're communists with a small c, and they believed that God was dual in nature, being both male and female, so men and women shared power equally in the communities. They were pacifists as well, and they believed in confession of sin to each other.
So there's a lot of potentially contentious issues with other not sects of faith, but different types of Christian faith, and you know the dualism and the progressive nature of a lot of the issues that you're talking about. That sounds like a recipe for conflict.
Actually, you know, that's very perceptive of you because some people like to paint them as these quiet, simple people, you know, apple pie and quiet, contemplative communities. That is not at all how they were. They actually were really rowdy worshipers, and they were constantly going against the grain of the outside world and the outside society. So we had actually done an exhibition a few years ago at the New York State Museum, and we called it The Shakers, America's Quiet Revolutionaries, just because they were so progressive and so far ahead of their time and constantly in battle and conflict with the outside world. Not so much with other religious groups, though. They love to talk about religion with other groups. They like to hear about different ideas. They thought that their way of life was the purest and the best path towards heaven. And, you know, they were trying to emulate Jesus Christ. So they did see themselves that way, but they didn't put down other people of other faiths.
Wow. Now you talk about them being, you know, rowdy worshipers. Isn't that kind of like why they're called Shakers?
Yeah, that was their actual name is the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing. And they believed that the Christ Spirit could be within anybody who lived a pure life. And that's, of course, the Shaker life, you know. So people in the outside world called them Shakers in much the same way that outsiders called the Quakers. It was reflective of the type of worship that they did in the 18th century, which was sort of a spirit possession type of experience where they would whirl around, crawl around on the ground and bark like dogs, you know, that sort of thing. And actually, there was a lot of groups doing that sort of activity in the 18th century, not just the Shakers.
Sounds like a fun service.
So before this interview started, you and I were chatting a little bit about some of the different ways that the Shakers have had an impact on our society in terms of women's roles and farming and even the New York State Legislature granting its first divorce based on the influence of the Shakers. Could you talk a little bit about any one or all of those issues and how they've had an impact on society?
Yeah, well, you know, the Shakers are really infused all through American culture. They've had a huge influence. Here in the Capital Region, we have the first three Shaker communities. So this is really the birthplace of the whole Shaker movement. It's where the garden seed industry was established. So there are many Shaker innovations, technological innovations. It's especially in agricultural technology. It's very important. But when you look at social history, you look at things like the divorce case involving Eunice Chapman, which was about 1812. There's a book about it called The Great Divorce by Ilion Wu. And it was the only divorce ever granted by the New York State Legislature. And what happened was this woman's husband joined the community and took the children, and that left her civilly dead. She could not own property. She could not earn an income. She could not remarry in any other, you know, or do anything to sustain herself. And she fought against the Shakers tooth and nail and eventually ended up getting that divorce from the New York State Legislature, and she got her children back. So it's this epic battle, actually, between her and a very powerful female leader in the Shaker community called Lucy Wright. So it's this really amazing story, and it's really set in Albany. It tells you a lot about Albany history if you read that book. So that's just one example of how they influenced the outside world. And it didn't immediately cause divorce to become legal, but basically they pushed the boulder, gave the boulder a push off the cliff because of their unique situation. Things like property laws were a real conundrum when it came to the Shakers and their communal ownership of property. And so in many different ways, they challenged the outside world and what were normal, you know, procedures and normal expectations.
Interesting. Wow. Can you talk more about kind of the culture within it? Because you, or I think you said, or I know rather, that they were celibate. And how did that, I guess, like how were relationships? Did they have romantic relationships or like what was that like?
Yeah, well, you know, they were humans. So we do know that some of them struggled pretty mightily with that charge, and some of them needed to leave. And if people couldn't conform to the many, many rules that govern their daily lives, it would be met with great sadness, and people, and they would be, you know, escorted out into the outside world. You know, within the community, the celibacy was really important for a couple reasons. First, because they wanted to be able to free themselves of the family so that they could devote themselves to worship. They wanted to be like Jesus Christ. Also, the founder of the Shaker movement, a woman named Anne Lee, you know, was born and raised in Manchester, England, which in the 1750s had atrociously high maternal and fetal mortality rates. So all four of her children died. And I don't think it's an accident that she and the other women who were involved in this group wanted to be celibate, to be freed from that cycle of birth and death that they were seeing all around them. The way they increased their numbers was by taking in orphans. So for a very long time, they fulfilled an important social service role in the areas where they had communities. And they would take in poor people, sick people, mentally ill people, as long as they were able to conform to the rules and contribute to the society, they were welcome.
Talking about the celibacy characteristic, it makes me think of monasticism and especially some of the devotion to crafts and skills that you can get with that, because you're refocusing a great deal of personal energy on these things. And that might be a good point to talk about some of the crafts that mm-hmm. the Shakers were involved in. The furniture obviously being the most famous perhaps,
right.
But you could talk about that a little bit and maybe some others.
Yeah, I mean, they saw work as a form of worship, and it was a pretty equal perspective on work. So it didn't matter if they were scrubbing a floor or building a piece of furniture. That work was important because it was a form of worship and a way of glorifying God. So the furniture tends to be well-crafted, you know, well-designed. It's simple. There's not a lot of ornamentation, but there's a great deal of grace and elegance in the designs that they created. And so if you go to a library and you look at the shelf with Shaker-related books, you're going to see dozens of books about Shaker furniture, because that is what really captured the imagination of especially Americans, but also people in England and Japan and Germany, especially in the 20th century. And so they had a huge influence on the history of design globally. Danish modern furniture was heavily influenced by Shaker design. To the Shakers themselves, You know, there's a famous quote by one of the Shaker Eldresses where she says she doesn't want to be remembered as a chair. And I'm totally with her on that, because much as I love the furniture, I've curated Shaker furniture collections, which are wonderful and just, you know, gorgeous. There hasn't been enough attention paid to their social history and they as individuals. And in recent years, more and more scholars are writing books about them as people and the many ways that they influence American history and culture.
This might be a good point to bring up the organization that you're part of, the Shaker Heritage Society, and talk about what your organization is about and the things that you focus on and offer to our community.
Sure. You know, Shaker Heritage Society was one of those bicentennial Save America's History kind of organizations founded in 1977. We don't own any of the historic site that we are charged with preserving. It actually was purchased by Albany County when the Shakers left in 1925. So we work really closely with the county. It's right across the street from the airport. So we also work closely with the airport. And the historic district isn't one square mile. So we're continually negotiating with developers who have new construction coming into the historic district to reduce the adverse impacts of those new developments. We also offer a lot of education programs. We're really well known for our K-12 education programs. And we're also well known for the craft fairs that we put on every year. We've got 3 shows we do every year. We work with about 100 local craft artisans, and we're really proud of our ability to help sustain all of these small family businesses. It's truly a symbiotic relationship. We only offer, we only allow vendors who hand make their products, so there's no buy, sell, made in China kind of things at our craft fairs. And we feel that that's a really important way to reflect the Shaker tradition of handicrafts. Now, mind you, they were very early in mass production technology and methodology, especially in their chair industry, which was huge at the Mount Lebanon site in New Lebanon. You know, they also were very savvy at marketing their products and that as well. But I think that that tradition of do it yourself and put your heart into your work is really important. And we certainly reflect that in our craft fairs at the site.
Do you know when your next craft fair is?
Yeah, it's September 8th and 9th.
Awesome, awesome. And so I've heard that you guys recently received a grant funding for restoration work and was recently designed or designated as a 7 to Save site by the Preservation League of New York State. Can you give us an idea of the variety of capital projects you have going on right now around that?
Sure. Yeah, we were thrilled to get the 7 to Save designation. The Preservation League of New York State is just an amazing organization that works really hard to preserve our cultural heritage. And it allows us to get statewide exposure for the work that we've been doing in the historic district for a long time. We did receive a $1 million grant for capital improvements. And $1 million sounds like a lot of money, but really we've got 9 buildings left in the church family property, and that's primarily going to go into roofs. We've got several roofs that need to be replaced. We're also going to have, this cracks everybody up, but we're turning the manure shed portion of the 1915 barn into a composting bathroom facility. So there's nice money for that as well. And that's really important economic development initiative, because we're using the property more and more for large-scale public events. For example, our Rotary clubs locally join together and they put on a pet expo every year. So we would like to have more and more groups using the site, and having that facility in the manure shed will make it much more, you know, easier to accommodate large groups on the grounds. And if you haven't been to the site, you've probably driven past the signs, but I suggest at least driving through it, because it truly is a rural oasis. It's this beautiful property. It's right across the street from the airport. We've got hiking trails around Anley Pond. We have a gorgeous herb garden. There's an apple orchard. We have oxen on the property.
I was gonna say, don't you guys have some animals?
We do. Thanks to Bob Riley, who's our former New York State Assemblyman. He's a volunteer at the museum and has been for many, many years. He owns the animals on the property, and he cares for them. And he has right now 2 Kerry cows on the property. And Kerry cows are a small breed of oxen that are an endangered species. So there's about 24 of them left in the United States.
Wow.
And Bob has been working really hard to try and propagate that species. So he goes to Ireland, actually, so that he can get the, you know, what he needs to bring back over here to propagate the species. And because the gene pool is too small in the States. And so that's a really cool program that we have. We cannot properly care for the oxen in the winter, so they go to a farm in the winter time. I mean, we're really careful to make sure that we're properly caring for these animals, but Bob really deserves all the credit because he does all the work.
Do you guys have a lot of volunteers?
We do. We have about 50 active volunteers. We're always looking for more volunteers. We need volunteers to help with our gift shop, our events, office work. Also, we're looking for tour guides and educator volunteers as well. So there's lots of opportunities to get involved.
Awesome. What would listeners need to do to get involved?
Just contact us. You can send an email to shakerdirector@gmail.com, and I will respond to you or send that on to one of the other staff to get back in touch with you.
So I thought it was interesting when you and I were talking earlier that you grew up out west and that your knowledge of Shakers was pretty limited or maybe not at all, but you became aware of this aspect of our cultural history. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I grew up in Colorado, not far from Rocky Mountain National Park. And, you know, in my history training, it was all manifest destiny all the time, really. We didn't talk a lot about the East Coast and what happened out here. It wasn't until I was in graduate school when one of my classmates did a material culture assessment of a Shaker bonnet that I had even heard of them. I had specialized in preventative conservation of textiles, and so I was hired by what is now the Shaker Museum Mount Lebanon to document and stabilize and rehouse their textile collection. And, you know, I figured I'd be there a short time, I'd do this project, I'd move on to some other textile curator position. But the more I learned about the Shakers, the more fascinated I became. And I realized what was such a seemingly narrow area of history actually touched on a huge number of different topics. I love the history of technology. I love studying, you know, women's role in society. I'm interested in farming history. And I think, you know, there's truly something for everyone. You can talk about their influence on dance, on the arts. I mean, it's just, it's endless.
It certainly sounds like it is. Well, thank you for joining us, Star. We really have enjoyed you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, if you want to know more about the Shaker Heritage Society, you can visit shakerheritage.org or swing by their museum in Watervliet and say hi to their Heritage Bridge oxen.
It's actually the town of Colony right across the street from the airport.
Ah, thank you for that. Thank you for that correction.